Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. This idea of men being nature's playthings, I think, is how I've heard you frame it in the past. And I'd love to give the audience the opportunity to hear you articulate what that exactly means from an evolutionary perspective in your judgment.
Okay. So this is more biology. This is not my expertise. This is what I've learned from other people. But it is true. It's clear in the psychological data that men are more different from each other than women are. There's more variance. It first came to my attention with intelligence, which is a very sensitive topic. But when they measure intelligence, the mean for adult men and women is pretty close, the average, that is. But there are more men at both extremes. Mm. And I brought this up with some biologists wondering why this could be and so on. And they noted that it's true in a variety of traits. There are more biological extremes. I mean, height even. Men on average are taller than women, clearly. But they're also more go to extremes more than women. Socially, it certainly happens. You see men at the top and at the bottom of society. Whether it's world leaders or in prison and homeless, more extreme there. So I was trying to find out: does it make sense? Is it plausible that evolution somehow figured out that it's better to gamble and to try new combinations with the male than the female? In evolutionary terms. For a species to progress, it wants the good mutations, which is sort of a random genetic thing, to spread through the population, and the bad ones to not spread, right, to be flushed out. Well, in a lot of species, more females than males reproduce, but the top males reproduce a lot more. So if you have a bad, most mutations are bad, they're maladaptive. So if you have a bad one, it'd be good to have that flushed out, have that person not reproduce at all. Well, you have a better chance of that with a male than with a female. And meanwhile, if you do come up with a good one, you want it to spread more. And the most productive males, the most successful males do have more offspring than the most productive females. I mean, it's very hard for a woman to give birth more than to a dozen children, and two dozen is, approaching a world record or something. Whereas there are plenty of men who have more children than that. And, they always point to Genghis Khan, who may have had 1,000 or more children. No woman could possibly have 1,000 children. The biological mechanism, as I understand, and this is speculation, it would go with the Y chromosome. So the X basically has a backup. So if something goes weird on one of the sticks, then there's a good chance that the other one will still be intact and can correct it. But the Y chromosome for the bottom of the Y, as it were, doesn't have a backup. Is more likely that a mutation will get translated into actual physical development and behavior. So in that sense, that is a possible explanation. And again, I'm not nearly expert enough to say whether it's correct. The biologists I've talked to said that that is plausible and makes sense, but that's far from saying this is this is really what happens. Anyway, that seems to be it, that nature can experiment more on males. I mean, this is a way of looking at nature as almost intentional, which, nothing is intentional now. But the blind process of evolution will produce more variations in the male than in the female, more for better and for worse. Mm.
And let's grant that this statement you just made is true. What are the implications of that in your mind for what we see in human beings?
Well, as a social scientist, I think whenever genetic contribution there is to behavior, and it's not a determinant, but it's a significant contributor. That's going to produce more males at both extremes. As I said, I first came across it with intelligence, it's apparently true. I consulted with experts, and there's plenty of evidence. There's more about the bottom end, just because we do more research on the mentally retarded, or whatever they're to be called now. That is, you go from mildly retarded to moderately to severely retarded, the proportion of boys, the ratio of boys to girls, gets bigger and bigger, more and more boys. And the data on genius show kind of the same thing, from moderate genius to, or from mild to moderate to extreme, more and more preponderance of males. I actually first heard this idea when I was in junior high school. I asked my mother, who was a school teacher, as kids would do, I said, well, so who's smarter, boys or girls? And she thought about it for a while. She'd been teaching for many years. And she said, well, I think the more boys at both extremes, the really smart and the stupid ones, and the girls tend to cluster in the middle a little more. So this was one school teacher's impression in the 1960s. But God bless her, a half a century later and tons of data, she was right. That tends to be what happens. And of course, there are women at every level. From the most genius to the most extreme. It's just that the nature will toss up more males toward the extremes. And apparently that's true in a lot of things. So as I said, to the extent genes contribute to behavior, they are likely accountable for this greater extremity of male behavior in both directions, again, for better and for worse.
Absolutely fascinating. I know we talked about this subject, and I want to stay on the theme of boys later in the conversation, but I have to put this to you to learn if your thinking has shifted at all in regarding this specific question. And it's about the existence of gay people in human beings. And I've heard you in a prior interview with someone else talk about the theory that you find most persuasive as to why gay people who would seemingly have been selected out of the gene pool, why it is that that is still a phenomenon in human beings. And I'd love to just put that to you and see if your thinking is basically exactly as it was when we last talked, I think about a year ago, or if you've been persuaded by other evidence that you've come across.
I haven't seen anything new in the past year. There's that work by Brendan Zeech, who was a colleague of mine at the University of Queensland. And of course, this has been a problem, a theoretical problem for centuries, because many cultures are against gay people. And I understand Iran just passed another law that engaging homosexual activity will send you to prison, if not get you executed. So culture is against it, and of course nature, if it doesn't reproduce, it doesn't help. So how come it keeps showing up generation after generation? What Zeech found was that to be sure, the gay people don't have that many children, but their siblings have more than average sex partners. There's something about having a mixture of male and female traits that makes you better able to relate to the other gender, the other major gender, and so improves your sexual outcomes, and so apparently that can compensate for the non-reproductive nature of being a pure homosexual. So I'm going to put it this way. This is the way I think they explain it, that if you're a total manly man, and you have all masculine traits, it's really hard to relate to a woman. And they may not communicate all that well with you. And so some feminine traits do help you understand them and relate to them and charm them and so on. And so improve your your chances of sexual activity, and perhaps a larger amount of these make you gay. Mm. So it's not. Remember, we looked for a long time for the gay gene. We as a field, I didn't, but and there were all these promising initial findings, and then they didn't replicate. What Zeitz says is something like homosexuality is likely, it's not going to be one gene, it's going to be lots and lots of genes. So it's not a single thing, it's a quantity. And that sort of fits, that there isn't an optimal point in the middle at which you have just the perfect personality to be sexually appealing. And departing from that in either direction, the one makes you less able to relate to the others, the one makes you less interested in relating to the others sexually. I mean, I have plenty of gay friends, and they get along very well with women, probably more than the super macho types. Mm. But of course, they're not interested in having sex with them the way that that heterosexual men are. Mm.
Fascinating. There is a book, the primary book of yours that I had mentioned before we kicked the conversation off, that I was studying for this conversation, is your book, Is There Anything Good About Men? And there is a book you reference in there that I had never heard of before that I thought was really interesting, that I wanted to bring up with you and get, you know, your takeaways from this book. And it's a book by Nora Vincent called Self-Made Man. Tell the audience, if you can, a little bit about what that book is and what to you matters about that book. What's still salient to you about that book in general?
Okay, yeah. One of my colleagues recommended that to me back when I was doing research for this. So this was a woman, a staunch feminist, who thought she looked manly enough that she would go undercover as a man for a year. And then write an expose of male privilege. So it was a clever idea. She studied a bit how to act a little bit more manly and to talk like a man and lower her voice and things, and dressing like a man and so on. And it seemed like she did. It was a very interesting personal story and a very entertaining book. So she wrote about what her experiences were, and a lot of people did indeed take her for a man. Some of them thought she was probably gay, but which fits our previous comment, because you know, some of her traits were certainly on the feminine side. Her main impression was there's no privilege to expose or anything, that it's tough being a man, and she found it a lot easier and nicer being a woman. In fact, she called off her experiment after half a year rather than going the full year as she planned, and said, it's a lot nicer to be a woman. And she had a lot of observations that fit that, you know, when you have a problem, you're upset about something, you show weakness, and in a woman that makes people want to come and help you. When she did this as a man, people disliked it and they wanted to stomp it out and not approve of that. So, crying would be sort of one example. I don't know if I don't recall if she used that or not, but a woman cries, you know, a lot of us men and women too feel tender and come around to help and to do what we can. You see a man crying, that's no good. It doesn't inspire the same kind of advantage. And she said, and she found herself going to bars to try to meet and pick up women, and they are, you know, rejecting you and so on. You have to have a very thick skin because you expect it to get rejected a lot. Whereas when she was a woman, she could just sit there and the men could approach her and she could decide whether she wanted to pursue that or not. So this and many other things like that showed differences in the life experience of men and women. She, I think, got a new increased a respect for men in some ways. At one point, she joined a bowling league to hang out with others. And she said, you know, I was terrible at bowling. And she said, you know, some of the men, even like men from the other teams, would come and offer me tips to help me to get better at it. And she said, this is just completely unheard of in women's society, that you come and offers somebody, especially a competitor, helps, you know, helpful tips to enable them to participate and compete better. So women's competition is just not like that at all. She found that kind of thing really very positive. But mostly the burdens of being a man and the responsibilities and what society expects to you, she found a lot more burdensome, whereas all this male privilege that she expected to find, she really couldn't see any sign of it.
I love this about your book. You know, you go into very nuanced detail about a lot of these subjects, and I think you give you observe the fact that it to some degree it's understandable that people would walk away from our society. You note this in your book that even still, most of the people who are in positions of power in our society, the CEOs, the people in Congress, presidents, are primarily men, but it's rare, and this was kind of a light bulb moment for me as well, reading your book, that never is that lens turned on its head. And this, I think, dovetails pretty nicely into what you were discussing perhaps earlier in the beginning of the conversation about some of these qualities and just the bell curve being wider for men. And you go into some detail, and I'd love to put this to you, about, you know, the homeless population being overwhelmingly men, the prison population being overly men. What were you trying to do in your book about men to tell the full story? What's the part of the story that you feel like is not commonly told or known in our culture about men?
Okay, so you're asking me what I had in mind when I wrote this book, which was something like 15 years ago. The title just kind of recognized it started from my experiences in social science, and I'm not primarily a gender researcher. My goal is to try to understand the human condition broadly conceptualized, and gender just happens to be a part of it. It's part of everybody's daily life, starting with when you get up and put on your clothes. So I couldn't really ignore that. And as I looked at the literature and also what I'd been exposed to in the media and stuff, you hear lots of stories about women are better at this and better at that and so on. And then you hear a fair number about there's no difference. But you know, when was the last time you heard somebody saying, oh, look, men are really better at this than women? That's a taboo. To mention it. And yet it's completely implausible that nature would make one gender all around better than the other. I see the world in terms of trade-offs. So whenever you're going to say women are better than men at this, it probably means that there's something else that men are better at. I mean, when there's a better way to be, men and women share a lot of genes, and nature's just going to favor everybody to be that way. So the idea that one gender is going to be better, which is the basic doctrine that's been shoved down our throats by the feminist establishment and the researchers and so on, is that just women are superior. I mean, we have data, sure, about something else, but happen to notice both men and women think that women are more intelligent than men. That's the prevailing stereotype in the United States. What you think about it is kind of absurd when you consider that almost all the innovations that have made life better from the Stone Age to the present were created by men. People believe women are smarter. I think they probably get this from the mass media, which are heavily censored. So that if, you know, something shows women looking bad, they will prevent it. But there's nobody objects to making men look bad and stupid. You know, the data, as we said, there are two expert opinions. One is that the average difference is negligible. Girls are a little smarter than boys. in school because they grow up faster. And then at around the teenage years, the boys catch up and forge very slightly ahead. But it's such a small difference as to be trivial. And then there's a new perspective that, well, maybe it's closer to 4 or 5 IQ points. It's not a big difference, but it's there. Of course, there are sampling issues too. You know, men more likely to get themselves killed or sent to prison, in which case they don't show up in your IQ testing sample. So there's some of that. Anyway, those are the expert opinions, and the experts pretty much agree that the important difference is in the extremities, the variance, the bell curve, the wider bell curve, than any difference in the mean. But people believe that, and believe that about a lot of other things too. Whereas that, you know, hence the title, Is There Anything Good About Men? We're not allowed to admit it, but it's implausible that women are going to be superior to men in lots of things, and men are not going to be superior to women in a roughly equal number of things.
And in your judgment, and based on your research, what is good about men? What about men? Where do men typically, again, these are averages, but where do men tend to have the upper hand? Where are the trade-offs favoring men in general and their capabilities?
All right. Well, where to start? I'd say one obvious thing that comes there is that men create social systems. Men work together in larger groups than women do. You can look at really the history of the world, and it's mostly groups of men competing against other groups of men to create progress, whether we're talking about scientists or military or business people, economic thing, governments. I mean, something like 200 countries in the world all created by groups of people. And that's a big forward step in social organization. As far as I can make out, there's not a one of them that was created by a group of women. Always groups of men. Women are happy to live in them and so on, but they don't create them themselves. When women began moving into the society we live in is basically built by men itself. And here in the United States, it's fashionable to complain about the United States, but I think it's a great country and a lovely place to live. And anyone born here after World War II, like, won the lottery of all the times and places you could have been born in the history of our species. But that seems to be that groups of men do that. And we looked at there's plenty of evidence, if the entire history of civilization doesn't convince you that men have that. There was a paper came out around the time I was doing my book, maybe came out just a little bit after, so it might not be in there, where they did a meta-analysis, which is a scientific technique to combine the results of, I think, 200 studies, you know, with economic games, where you have to make a decision. Are you going to cooperate with other people and expose yourself to some risk, or are you going to take care of yourself and screw the other people, so to speak? So they looked at cooperativeness. That, I think, is one of the major thrusts of human evolution, is cooperation. We cooperate much more extensively than any other species. And it's going to be a lot of genes, so both men and women will have them. And so, remarkably, there was no total difference between men and women in the cooperativeness, but there were different patterns. In particular, men cooperated with men, men cooperated with women, women cooperate with men very well. But women didn't cooperate with women. And these are not hunter-gatherers like from our evolutionary history or whatever. These are mostly modern university students, highly educated, and so on and so forth. And yet still, there's a deficit in terms of women cooperating with other women. It sets up some interesting prediction. When women moved into the men's sphere, the individual women did fine, and my career has certainly been blessed by working with lots of very fine female scientists, men too. It's just been a wonderful, and I love a lot of those people. But when women take over as a group and become the majority, they seem to import women's values. And so the commitment to science and rigor takes a backseat to doing what is best for society and for the projects of women, too. Other people have written more about this recently than I have, so I know what they say. I can't evaluate it or take a strong opinion. Some comments, you know, that women now are in charge of the Ivy League, which is eight of the world's top universities here in the United States. And, the early returns from female management, which, you know, most of the presidents, most of the administrators, and most of the students are female. The professors, the women are, the younger professors are also more women. There's still some older males. But we see the departure from commitment to the truth, the more taking sides on socially divisive political issues, other things happening that, we'll see. But, you know, the early returns are not so so encouraging. So one of my colleagues, Corey Clark, has studied this more extensively. She has poll data where she surveyed several hundred scientists as to, you know, what is the purpose of science? Is it to follow the data and advance knowledge wherever the truth leads? Or is it to do what's good in society and make people safer and more comfortable? Or it's complicated. And most of the men said, well, the purpose is to follow the data wherever they go, and whether you like it or not, to find the truth. And most of the women said, it's complicated. So the commitment to truth is weaker, which you can understand. Science emerged from the men's sphere. We have to keep in mind that the hunter-gatherers were very equal, relentlessly egalitarian. And that's most of human history. If civilization is existed for 150,000 years, 140,000 people were hunters and gatherers. And they're very equal, and the men and the women were equal, and they both contributed calories and stuff. The women were more the gatherers, contributing calories every day. The men were more the hunters, contributing protein, but more erratically. Both, you know, they worked together and so on. But the men's sphere and the women's sphere was pretty equal, and yet civilization emerged from the men's sphere. And that, I think, is really the origin of gender inequality, which is an empirical fact, and I think just about every society in the world today. It's not some conspiracy that the feminists have wanted to tell us that somehow the men banded together and decided they would oppress the women and hold them down and so on. Evidence for that is really, really lacking. But it's instead that the men, by working together, created all sorts of progress in groups that lifted themselves up and actually lifted the women up too. I don't think they pushed the women down. They just lifted themselves up more because wealth, knowledge, and power were created through men's interactions. And it to me goes back substantially to this larger group style. I remember we read laboratory studies, I forget who did them, where they'll have two children playing and they'll bring in a third. And if it's two girls and the researchers bring in a third girl, they don't want her. They want a one-to-one relationship. It spoils it for them. So they will exclude the third one. Whereas the two boys will let the boy in. And I'm not saying boys are better or more moral or anything like that. It doesn't spoil it for the boys. The larger group is fine, whereas the girls are more oriented toward the one-to-one relationship. And this is true in adulthood as well. And so if we think of culture as progress, as a system of sharing information and trade and other things, the larger network is a more fertile ground for it, a one-to-one relationship. And that's the female priority, and that's the more important for making the species survive, right? Mm. The mother-child bond has to be there, and it's pretty much the same everywhere in the world. It's interesting that the father-child bond is much more variable historically and culturally than the mother-child bond. But everybody needs the one-to-one relationship to get started, so the women are doing the more essential thing. But in terms of culture, just look at shared information. Two people can share information. All right, that's better than one, but 20 people can share a lot more information and correct it much more rapidly and so on. And so the men's sphere with the larger groups and the larger networks become a more fertile ground for progress in culture. I remember I was working on this. People told me, you know, male consultants, executive consultants, and so on, they have bigger networks too. This is back when they had the Rolodex on paper, and you can just sort of count how many entries. They just have more as well, and they're more interested in building a big kind of network. Again, I think we need to appreciate the strengths of both men and women, but they're both real, but they are different. As I said, in nature, evolution, if there's a better way to be, it will make everyone that way. But if there's a trade-off, one's better for one thing, the other for the other thing, then it will preserve differences. And so that's how I understand differences between men and women, mostly, again, in terms of these trade-offs with the large group, small group, the one-to-one relationship versus the bigger group being front and center is one of the decisive ones.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Roy. That's fascinating. And, you know, you may have already answered this by indicating that, you know, understandably for women, the one-to-one dynamic is crucial to the survival of the species because they're the mothers. Whereas men have never had that role. And so many of the interviews I like to have on the show are trying to better understand human nature. And I've had plenty of evolutionary psychologists on the show to you know, ask these sort of questions. And again, you may have already answered this, but from an evolutionary lens, what's the best explanation in your mind as to why these differences, you know, related to this level, this interest that seemingly exists in men on average to do large-scale cooperation? How does that fit into your model of the evolutionary history of men? Why are men wired that way?
I'm not as sure how specific to humans that is. So we're going a little here beyond my expertise. I know Michael Tomasello is one of the researchers I admire most, and I've read a number of his books. The guy's brilliant. He talks about the transition to morality in one of them, The Natural History of Morality. He says chimpanzees will hunt in groups, although really each one is out for himself. That you get more opportunities as part of a group. So the chimpanzees, they will chase a monkey because they like to eat monkey meat. So if you're out in the group and the monkey runs up a tree, the first couple chimpanzees will follow it up the tree. If you're the third or fourth one, well, you're not going to get it anyway. So you might go and look for blocking off the escape route. You see, well, if it does jump down, maybe it'll go over here and I'll catch it. So there is an advantage to yourself to taking part in the group, but it's not cooperation in the human sense. One way that humans learned to hunt was a part of the group will go to one place and form a row and make a lot of noise and has chased the wild animals away, and then the other ones will wait at the other end with their spears or bows and arrows or whatever, or traps, and catch them when they come that way. The chimpanzees would never do that because the noisemakers wouldn't get anything to eat. But the humans will make an agreement that we cooperate, we'll work together, and so it yields more resources. So this kind of thing helped the men discover how to work together. Now, in terms of developing these ideas, I have more thoughts along these lines, and I may be working on another theory paper on this this fall, that recruiting the male into the role of provider was a crucial step in human evolution. It goes with, in order for there to be the big brain, the baby has to be born prematurely, which means it's dependent for a long period of time. A baby gorilla starts to feed itself, 5 months or something, and is pretty much on its own by 3 years. But of course, there's no human society where a human 3-year-old can function as an adult. So none of the other apes take any notion of fatherhood or really care about it or even show any particular preference toward their own children, let alone providing food and protection and shelter on a daily basis for 10 or 20 years, which is the norm for the modern human male. So that is a huge change, which required a number of biological changes to attach the man to the woman. And this is sort of, if it's true, this is what's going to cement the woman's commitment to the one-to-one relationship, because, you know, her baby needs protein, and she's not going to be getting much by herself. And then the women don't organize into groups to do that as well as the men were doing that. So the best prospect for the woman is to form a one-to-one relationship with the man who can provide for her children and as well as for her herself. Which would have been unthinkable to the gorillas and chimpanzees and so on. I mean, why should you be feeding just some gorilla you had sex with 5 years ago? they would think that's ridiculous that you'd have some obligation. So that was a big change, but it also increased the men's workload and put more burden on the men to figure out ways to produce more. If an adult, say a chimp or a gorilla, has to forage for, I don't know, 3 hours a day to feed himself, now he's got to feed a wife and a couple kids. That's doubling his workload. So he'd be extra receptive to figuring out how to work with the other guys who are in the same boat to produce more resources by cooperating in novel ways. And so that transition would spur the men to move forward, to develop these large group cooperations to produce advantages. But again, that's how wealth, knowledge, and power got created in the men's sphere, while the women's sphere essentially doesn't produce progress. And I love women. A lot of my favorite people are women. But cooperating in large groups to produce progress doesn't seem to be one of their strengths. And I've had a number of my female colleagues basically say they were frustrated with that same fact. Hmm.
Absolutely fascinating. That's mind-blowing. I want to read a few quotes from your book, Is There Anything Good About Men? And then bring up a subject that we talked about a year ago to have you share with the listeners your general thoughts on it. And here are some quotes from your book. Quote, "We are descended from the men who fought their way to the top. They had to outdo other men. Their desire for sex was part of what drove them to do that. The hankering to rise to the top is probably quite deeply rooted in the male psyche, thanks to evolutionary selection." Here's another one. "Women, perhaps especially thoughtful women, simply cannot fathom the strength of the male sex drive and the ache of sexual frustration that pervades so many hours of a man's life." Here's another one. Quote, "Every male is descended mostly from alpha males. Occasionally, a lesser male can manage to copulate and make a baby, but these are exceptions, and the line of ancestors consists mainly of the alphas." And then here's a final one, quote, "To the extent that women competed with each other, they competed to get a better versus less desirable mate. And they did this not by besting other women at physical tasks, but by being more beautiful and sweet and lovable than others." We talked the last time we had a conversation about a phrase that has stuck with me ever since I heard it from you, which is the tragedy of the male sex drive. And you recounted a study that was done, which I'd love for you to share if you're open to it, about, I think it was college students being asked for their ideal number of sex partners in their lives, contrasting the data with women. I'd love to just open up this subject to you, the tragedy of the male sex drive, and have you share what you recall about that study and what you really mean when you use that phrase, the tragedy of the male sex drive.
Okay. Well, first, let me back up that we're descended from the alpha males and so on. This was, now it's 20 years old, but it was still fairly new when I wrote the book, the DNA finding that our ancestors, if you look at all the humans who are alive today, what proportion of our ancestors were women? It's about 2/3. Many people are surprised by that. I'm told the the biologists, the real experts, are surprised in the opposite direction, because in many species, it would be 90%. Most ordinary people think, well, equal number of boys and girls are born, so it should be 50-50. But to be an ancestor, you had to do more than just be born. You had to reproduce in a line that extends down to the present. Women prevailed there, and the explanation is fairly simple, that polygamy has existed in most societies. So the highly successful men will have multiple partners and multiple offspring, whereas the low status male is often left out and becomes a biological dead end. Whereas far more women reproduce than men, but as we said before, they don't reproduce that many. It's rare for a woman to have more than about a dozen children, and even that's pretty considerable wear and tear on the female body. It's coming down now that we've enacted monogamy, which is often presented as a gift to women. But if you look at who really benefits from monogamy, it's the low status men, because the high status men can't hog all the women who are having four or five wives each. There are more women to go around. On the sex drive, I've come to suspect, and I don't know how to test this, but I would put forward the hypothesis that the male sex drive, the human male sex drive, is higher than in our other animal relatives, the chimpanzees. And I don't know quite, again, how to test that. But nature had to bond the man and the woman in a lasting way so that the baby could be taken care of for a longer period of time than any of the chimps or gorillas or orangutans will do. And so, well, what bonds a man to a woman? Sexual desire is one thing. So, I mean, when this evolutionary process was taking place, there must have been some early hominins, early men who said, what? I'm supposed to provide for her every day? You're kidding me. That's nuts. And they'd have the same attitude of a self-respecting gorilla. But those guys took themselves out of the gene pool, right? We're descended from the ones who said, oh, I love you, I adore you, I want to take care of you for the rest of my life, I'll do anything you want. You're my ideal. Sexual desire was part of that. And remember, for the species to survive, I mean, we say, my wife is a total sweetheart and is adorable and it's a pleasure to be with her. But I've known enough other women, and some of them are difficult to get along with. But nature wants them to reproduce too. And so, well, I've heard men say, she's a lot of high maintenance, difficult, but the sex is so good. So the high sex drive would be at least one factor that would encourage the man to enter into this somewhat self-sacrificing, altruistic relationship where he provides for her over a longer period of time. I even have a somewhat wilder theory about that, which could be completely wrong, independent of all the rest of my thinking on this. But maybe exploring the literature on this too, but human males get addicted more than females. You look at heroin addicts or alcoholics or whatever. And it doesn't appear to be true in other species, though we don't have a lot of data. But many people study lab rats because the rat brain is supposedly a good analogy. And those ones who study addiction use females because they get addicted more readily. So what changed to make the male more susceptible to addiction? And as far as I could tell, the opioid crisis and so on, that was more gender neutral. But my thought about that is that to go from feeling miserable to, from minus 10 to zero, everybody wants that. Stop the pain or whatever. Yeah, that's there. But to go to zero to bliss, That's much more of a male undertaking. And so we're selected in favor of wanting intense pleasures. I mean, I used to windsurf, the same kind of thing. There were women who windsurf, but a lot more men. It's just the solitary bliss of cruising up and down on the water at high speeds is just a basic joy. Why then would the human male have evolved to be susceptible to addictions to bliss? And that could be part of what bonds the man to the woman, to keep his sexual desire for her, that when he says, wow, this is so great, I want to keep doing this. We know too that over the early course of a marriage, the woman's sexual desire diminishes while the man stays about the same. This is a paper McNulty did a couple years ago. And so that would help with that, because like an addict continuing to go back thinking maybe it'll be good. And every so often it is still as good as it ever was. But, of course, for nature's project to be there, he has to stay with the woman and the child to continue providing at least long enough so that the baby becomes an older child and somewhat able to cope with itself. So anyways, I said, that's possibly a crazy idea and could go wrong in multiple ways. And I don't know all the research, but it's hard to find any other theory about why the human male would suddenly become prone to addiction to bliss drugs and bliss experiences. But it would make valuable sense if that's what helps bond the man psychologically to the woman he's having sex with, so that he'll stick around long enough to provide for her and her babies.
Mind blowing. I would love to just open it up to you to, I know you prefaced your last statement with the fact that, it's speculation, that you don't have an incredibly high confidence in that, but it's a very interesting idea. What else is of interest to you right now? What counterintuitive ideas, what lines of research are just particularly fascinating to you, or even weird ideas that you've heard that you think are just incredibly interesting or revelatory about human nature? I know that's a very broad statement, but I'd love to have you spend a little bit of time on, what's fascinating you these days.
I just finished a book on free will, which is coming out in September, so fairly soon, and that was a fascinating project. I think, when these debates go on decades or centuries, it's often either they're framing the problem wrong or the two sides are talking past each other. And I think there's some of both of those. So that's a whole argument. But even the people who are skeptical, I've talked to many scientists who accept free will and many who reject it. You'd think they'd have very different ideas about how behavior is caused, but they don't. They even agree that the human system, what goes on in the human brain and mind to guide behavior, is way different from anything else, certainly anything you'd see in chimpanzees or gorillas. I mean, even what we're doing right now and talking via technology about big ideas, gorillas don't do anything like this. So they agree that the human system is really remarkably beyond anything else. They're mainly disagreeing as to whether this marvelous new system should be called free will. And that's basically a terminology question. To me, the scientific challenge is let's figure out how this marvelous new system works. And so that's kind of how I focused my book, that most animals live in the immediate here and now. In the present, very little sense of time and very little concern with past or future, whereas we see our present moment as embedded in an ongoing story or set of stories extending well into the past and into the future. So there's the use of time, there's ability to use abstract ideas to cause behavior, much more extensive shared body of knowledge to operate on as the basis for society. So anyway, that's a big topic I was quite interested in. My book before that was on the self, which is something I've been studying for decades, really. I got started on that in graduate school. And so I wanted to pull together to understand what is the self and how does it come into being. The basis of my thinking is the human mind was created by nature for culture. So that was created by evolution, but our biological strategy for solving the problems of survival and reproduction, every species has to solve those, otherwise it goes extinct. And our species solves them with culture. We organize into social systems, share information, have division of labor with interlocking roles, all that stuff. It's a very successful system. I mean, look at our population is up to 8 billion, whereas the chimpanzees, our closest relative, are down to something like 300,000. And indeed, most mammal populations are declining in the world while ours continues to grow up. So in purely biological terms, it's a very successful system, but takes advanced mental powers to do that, which is why the others don't really pick it up and why we had to evolve this capacity to grow a much bigger brain and to grow it after birth, because, you know, what's the woman supposed to be pregnant for 6 years and then give birth to a six-year-old boy, which would kill her? So all these changes there. Anyway, the self is sort of the interface between the physical body, the animal creature, and the social system with organized by culture. And so the self comes into being as the brain learns to operate a role in the social system. So so that's done. That was a book out the year before last. In terms of what I'm thinking of next, I wrote a book on meaning of life long time ago. And since then, there's been a ton of research. There wasn't much then. I'm thinking of revisiting that. I've been thinking about uncertainty as a interesting phenomenon. It's here to stay. People have a very negative stereotype of uncertainty, although there's some positives to uncertainty. I'm starting to think the opposite of uncertainty is boredom, which we don't like either. So there's a certain spice of life quality to uncertainty, and yet it is have a variety of effects. Conserving resources. We see even in the animal world, uncertainty in the environment stimulates many fairly simple animals to conserve resources. It's probably because that was adaptive. When you don't know what's going to happen, having more food will enable you to survive it. If there's a week where you can't find anything to eat. And so humans, we conserve a variety of resources. I had all that research on willpower as an energy resource, and people seem to conserve that when they're confronted with uncertainty. So they're reluctant to take action, and they cut back on self-control and other things, which is a way of conserving resources. So that's been of interest too. Anyway, I'm rambling from one thing to another, but a lot of things are interesting. So, as I said, I've set myself the goal. I want to figure out the human condition and what the human mind is all about. And I give myself a 50-50 chance of getting there, kind of as a joke. I've learned a lot about a lot of different things. You know, academic life doesn't really encourage you to be a generalist. It's really best for the system if everybody kind of picks one topic, devotes his or her career to that, and makes as much progress on that. So, but it's good to have a few people who go around looking for the big picture and trying to combine it. And for that, you have to build on other people's work. So I have a much more positive view of the contributions of the majority of social scientists than many of my peers, who are often very critical of each other.
Yeah.
But I have to believe that most social scientists are sincere, honest, hardworking things who will have some good ideas and occasionally wrong ones. So that's been my goal. And as I said, the male-female thing was part of that, because there's no coming up with a theory of what it means to be human, ignoring the male or female aspect, since it's relevant in every society. And like I said, it starts when you get putting on your clothes in the morning.
Hmm. And what in your, you know, history of investigating these subjects has How have you changed? What, you know, I don't know if you entered this field with a more agnostic view of human nature, but I'd be curious to know how your general research on the field has influenced how you look at yourself, look at, you know, our society in general. Is there a noticeable change in your mind? Do you feel like you were wrong about some things that you used to believe that you've now changed your mind on because of all of your years studying this stuff?
Oh, yes, plenty. I had to assume very early that my goal is to end up knowing the truth, and I assume I don't start out knowing it. And so so I have to change my views on a lot of things. When I went to college, I remember my first course in psychology of personality, and the professor said, well, personality is something you learned. The idea that there's some genetic or biological basis, we don't really. And this was not an idiosyncratic view. This was the majority view back then. And I liked that view myself. I was sort of sympathetic to it, but there's been no question over the years, the masses of data piling up to show that there is a substantial biological, physiological contribution, that personality, well, let's say it's about half genes on a lot of traits. They look at heritability and so on, even things like our identical twins who are reared apart more similar than non-identical twins who grew up in the same household, and often they are, which is a pretty strong sign that it's not the environment, that there's a contribution of genes. Now, I don't want to go the other extreme and say the genes determine who you are. The genes start you off in one direction, but there's a lot of environment, and their interactions between the genes and the environment can turn genes on or off. Even things like intelligence, which is probably more genetic than, say, whether you're an extrovert, introvert, or you're talkative or honest or whatever. Even things like that, there is room for environmental things. I remember when my baby was born, I went around, because I decided by then I only like smart people. I wanted to have a smart kid. And I talked to all the experts on intelligence. You know, what can I do to maximize her? And they sort of looked at me. I remember one said, well, try not to drop her on her head. I said, come on, that was already one of my plans. I wanted to know what kind of music to play in her curve. And he said, yeah, you know, you take the average of the parent's IQ, and that's going to be a pretty strong predictor of where the child's intelligence is. There's some evidence that if you're a really bad parent, you can lower your kid's IQ, but you can't. The genetic link is higher among higher socioeconomic statuses. So it's not that they are boosting their kids' IQ by hiring tutors and things like that. They're just creating an environment that allows the genes to shine through. Whereas if you're a bad parent, you can make your kids stupider by being abusive or neglectful or whatever. But we're really talking about the very low end. And, you know, I remember the advice from parents that you want to be in the top 90%, and then the rest of it is genetic. So all these things, you know, mothers drive themselves crazy trying to be the perfect mother, and just don't drop them on his head. make sure the kid is fed and so on, and then that will do it. And give yourself a break. So that's been one change, is to accept the biological input, and then to recognize the evolutionary things that went along to it. I resisted that for a while. I've come along. But even in my own the topics of study, I started out very high on self-esteem. I thought that was interesting when I was an early researcher on that. And so I thought, well, that's an exciting and important trait. And sadly, over the years, became convinced that it doesn't have a lot of powerful predictive, at least for objective outcomes. High self-esteem does make you feel better. For example, one of the longitudinal studies after we published our critique saying self-esteem doesn't do much, they think, look. So followed people over time, self-esteem at time one made you more happy with your salary at time two. It didn't get a higher salary, though. The salary was no different. The objective outcome was the same. It just made you more likely to embrace it. And self-esteem is a substantial genetic component too. So it's not clear that the boosting kids' self-esteem is going to make them happier with their salary. So I was kind of disappointed by that. I did all that research on willpower as limited research. We had multiple changes to the theory as from our lab and from a variety of other creative people who came up with interesting revisions that, you know, when you show these ego depletion effects, that that the person has run out of willpower. It's just conserving, much like with physical muscles. It turns out you start feeling tired and conserving your energy long before the muscle is unable to function anymore. And the physio exercise labs show that you can have somebody come to the lab, work out, you know, for half an hour, get his muscle plenty tired, and then say, well, if you can match one single press as strong as you did when you started out, we'll give you $10 or something. They can do it. They're still capable of that. So the brain is manufacturing fatigue and tiredness and so on as signals to conserve. So that was all new to me. The link to glucose, the physical energy, has worked very well for us. Some people don't find the link. And so that's, I'm not as knowledgeable about physiological stuff as social stuff. Clearly there's something there, I think. So that theory revised multiple times too. Anyway, I try to make a virtue of changing my opinions when the new evidence comes in. I know many scientists think, oh, you got to fight for the debt to the death for your opinion. When the evidence comes in, like I said, I assume I don't start out knowing the truth, and so I got to change my ideas to end up there.
And I think that's a very healthy mindset to have. And I know we're getting close to the end of our time together, Roy. And I want to close with asking you, you know, in the spirit of seeking the truth and wanting to know the truth, who in your mind are, you know, people worth reading, following, watching that you respect, you admire, you think are operating in good faith in the spirit of trying to find out what's true? And I wouldn't surprise me if there are dozens of people that would fit into that category for you. But if any come to mind that, you know, people who watch this or listen to this who, you know, love your stuff and want to consult your stuff and also find out who you trust, where would you point people to?
Let's see. I already mentioned Michael Tomasello. He's one of the most careful and informed in terms of the difference between humans and other animals. And so several of his books have really influenced me. Francis Fukuyama, I think, is a marvelous mind, an extraordinary genius. His Origins of Political Order, I think, is the name of his book. It's actually there are two of those, and it starts from the evolutionary background and goes through political history. He's a political scientist, and that's just something I've wondered about. It's part of the big picture. How did we get from roaming tribes of nomads, sleeping outdoors and whatnot, to the United States and hotels and everything else that we have. He's another. Steven Pinker, I've enjoyed a number of his things. A wonderful mind and a marvelous writer, and tackles lots of fascinating things. Those would be a couple off the top of my head. If you give me a little more time, I could probably think of some more, but those are excellent people.
Very good. Roy Baumeister, ladies and gentlemen. Roy, great to see you again. Thanks so much for coming back on.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.